These women have spent their entire lives in luxury. Trained from birth in the art of pleasure, they know nothing of the world beyond the king's royal court. But two of these women are about to die a gruesome death. The name of their executioner is one you might have heard. Sun Tzu, warrior, philosopher, and creator of the Art of War. This ancient text holds the keys to victory in war and life. Now, the Art of War's tactics and strategies are revealed in graphic detail to help solve a military mystery. Were the outcomes of America's greatest battles foretold some 2,000 years ago? Did the Art of War prophesize the Nazis' ultimate doom? Predict how the North would win the Civil War? And predict why America would be defeated in Vietnam? Understand the Art of War's lessons, and you will prevail. Ignore them, and you fight in darkness. King Helu, ruler of the Chinese state of Wu, agonizes over a growing threat. A hostile neighbor is poised to invade. Desperate to defend his kingdom, Helu summons one of the greatest military minds in history, Sun Tzu.
Sun Tzu is important because he has a cohesive, holistic philosophy of how to approach strategy. If you listen to Sun Tzu, if you follow his principles, you will be victorious. If you ignore him, you do so at your own peril, because you will definitely lose.
Sun Tzu assures King Helu that he can train the smaller Wu army to overcome and defeat the larger invading force.
King Helu asks Sun Tzu, challenges Sun Tzu in something of a mocking way. He says, "You claim that you can turn anyone into a soldier. Can you turn these palace women, these spoiled, soft concubines, into a fighting force?" Sun Tzu answers, "Of course I can." He simply shows the women what the important maneuvers are. He chooses the two most senior of these concubines to serve as platoon leaders and charges them with making sure discipline is observed in their units.
But when Sun Tzu orders the exercise to begin, the women simply laugh.
Sun Tzu say, "Well, okay, maybe my instructions were not clear to you. Now, let me rephrase again my instructions to you in simple language." He told the concubines, "When the drums is sounded, you as concubines must assemble as soldiers with your spears, with your swords, and fall in line." Second time. What happens? They still giggle away.
But Sun Tzu says, if the orders are unclear, it is the fault of the general that the troops do not obey. But if the orders are clear, and my orders have been clear, it's the fault of the subordinate officers that the orders are not obeyed.
There is only one way Sun Tzu can convince the concubines that he is deadly serious. To Sun Tzu, war is a matter of life and death. This is the key principle of his teachings. Once understood, everyone from the leader down to the individual soldier will be motivated to win. Sun Tzu appoints two new officers. The women now follow his orders without hesitation.
And the big takeaway from this incident for King Helu is that even a state like Wu which is relatively weak in terms of numbers compared to its larger neighbor Chu, can nonetheless wield a disciplined, effective military force if they take Sun Tzu's teachings to heart and implement them throughout their military.
While these women will never see battle, Sun Tzu has proved his point. King He Lu appoints Sun Tzu as commander of the Wu army. Sun Tzu must now make good on his promise to train a force of 30,000 to fight an army 10 times larger. The strategies and tactics he uses in this showdown become the foundation of his masterwork, The Art of War. Sun Tzu writes The Art of War around 500 BC. The book is written on vertical bamboo strips, each the length of a chopstick. Each strip contains 15 to 25 Chinese characters. The strips are then painstakingly stitched together. Inside the 13 chapters of The Art of War lie the secrets to success.
Basically, if you understand The Art of War and the principles in it, you can predict how wars or battles will turn out.
The Art of War is filled with many important insights, but there are three key principles that stand out and unify Sun Tzu's philosophy. Sun Tzu says, "Know your enemy and know yourself, and in 100 battles, you will never be in peril." In The Art of War, understanding your opponent is crucial to victory. Sun Tzu says, "To win 100 battles is not the height of skill. To subdue the enemy without fighting is. Fighting costs lives and money. Sun Tzu prizes the general who can outwit instead of outfight his opponent." Sun Tzu says, "Avoid what is strong. Attack what is weak." Throughout history, armies fight head to head on the battlefield to show their strength and courage. But Sun Tzu doesn't care about glory. He only wants to win.
While each of these principles is important, think of them as cords in a strong rope. Individually, they may be strong, but when you put them together and use them holistically, they're unbreakable.
For more than 1,000 years, Sun Tzu's secrets are kept hidden, made available only to emperors and authorized scholars. They surfaced in the 8th century in Japan, and since then, their insights have spread throughout the world. More recently, The Art of War has spawned hundreds of books that apply its teachings to sports, politics, and business. Today, it's part of the core curriculum at many war colleges, including West Point. But as we shall see, Sun Tzu's advice isn't always heeded, which often leads to disaster.
I think throughout time, if generals had listened to Sun Tzu, you would probably not have seen a lot of the bloody wars of attrition that mankind has suffered through. He was very focused on how do I achieve my goal with the minimum amount of resources used, with the minimum amount of destruction.
Sun Tzu's principles are about to be put to the test. Sun Tzu has trained the army of Wu to defend itself against the powerful state of Chu to the west.
The outset of this war between Wu and Chu, when Sun Tzu is given command of an army of Wu, it seems that Chu holds all the advantages. Sun Tzu's army is only about 33,000 men, where Chu can field forces of hundreds of thousands of men.
Leading 300,000 Chu warriors is a power-hungry and corrupt prime minister named Nang Hua. Nang Hua cuts a swath of destruction through the Chinese countryside. Outnumbered nearly 10 to 1, Sun Tzu could prepare his defenses and wait for the Chu onslaught. But being Sun Tzu, he does the unexpected. He invades Chu. Sun Tzu doesn't attack Nam Hwa's army head on. He chooses soft targets, like remote outposts and border crossings.
It would be unwise for Sun Tzu to try to seek a decisive engagement early in this war by attacking the Chu army directly. He simply does not have the mass necessary to do that.
Sun Tzu attacks with blistering speed and brutal efficiency. Nam Hwa immediately launches counteroffensives, but when the reinforcements arrive, Sun Tzu's soldiers are gone and attacking the next location.
By keeping Chu constantly shifting its forces back and forth on the frontier, he frustrates their leaders and gains, at the same time, a much better picture of the way the Chu armies will likely fight.
After every battle and skirmish, Sun Tzu gains a better understanding of his enemy.
He downplays the value of direct attack and puts the emphasis on maneuver, surprise, deception.
All warfare should be based upon the intellect. In fact, the greatest battles of all time have been won by the brain and not by brute force.
That doesn't stop Nam Hwa from trying. He eventually launches 100,000 soldiers to try to crush the guerrilla attacks.
And this reminds me of the difference between chess and the Chinese game of Go. Chess is very much attrition-based. You start the board with many, many pieces. Over the game, they're eliminated. And at the end, you've only got a few pieces left standing.
The object of chess is to force your opponent to surrender by eliminating his pieces. Each piece has its own rank and can only move in a specific way. The goal of chess is to kill the king.
In contrast to that, the Chinese game of Go starts with a board empty, and you use as few pieces as possible to acquire as much territory as you can. And in that sense, it's a very resource-efficient strategy.
The object of Go is not the destruction of the opponent's force, but the conquest of space. The goal of Go is to capture the most territory with the least number of stones. Using a Go-like strategy, Sun Tzu decides where and when he fights. He avoids the strongest part of Nam Hwa's army and attacks where it is weakest. Sun Tzu's guerrilla tactics against the Chu forces echo throughout history. But it's during an infamous war more than 2,000 years later that they resonate most loudly, and where Sun Tzu's ultimate secret becomes most evident. It's the mid-1960s, and the world's greatest superpower battles North Vietnamese communists in a country smaller than the state of Montana. General William Westmoreland, a hard-nosed World War II combat officer, sees the battlefield like a chessboard, where armies stand and fight head-on. But unlike chess, Vietnam has no clear objective for Westmoreland to attack.
It's a classic case of a general fighting the last war, and in the sense that the lessons he had learned there only applied partially to Vietnam. There were no fixed objectives to be taken. There were no fixed units to be destroyed.
No one understands this better than North Vietnamese General Vo Nguyen Giap, who sees Vietnam, like Sun Tzu would, as a go-board. Instead of facing the overwhelming U.S. military directly, he uses insurgent forces, the Viet Cong, to stage hit-and-run attacks all over the country.
We see something very similar to Sun Tzu's raids into Chu in North Vietnamese tactics and operations in the Vietnam War.
Giap has learned Sun Tzu's principle that it is more important to outthink your enemy than to outfight him. And it's tactics and strategy, not overwhelming firepower, that causes the U.S. to ultimately lose the war in Vietnam, a loss that Sun Tzu predicted thousands of years earlier. How Sun Tzu was able to do this as well as predict the outcome of the invasion of Normandy and the final harrowing day of battle at Gettysburg is about to be revealed. Sun Tzu says, in war, numbers alone confer no advantage. Do not advance relying on sheer military power. It's the mid-1960s in Vietnam. U.S. General William Westmoreland orders intense aerial bombardments. The U.S. will eventually drop nearly 7 million tons of bombs on Indochina during the war, more than twice the tonnage of all the bombs dropped by the U.S. in World War II. But the Americans are about to learn Sun Tzu's lesson the hard way, that despite overwhelming military power and the valor of its soldiers, the U.S. cannot win this war.
Between 1959 and 1975, the North Vietnamese fought a very desperate war against the South Vietnamese government and their U.S. allies. And even though they were heavily outgunned, when you look at how the war was fought and see that through Sun Tzu's eyes, it's obvious how they prevailed.
Westmoreland uses a chess-inspired strategy. Stop the communist spread by killing as many North Vietnamese and Viet Cong as possible. Conversely, Westmoreland's adversary, the North Vietnamese general Vo Nguyen Gia, uses more of a Sun Tzu Go strategy.
Westmoreland is trying to attrit the enemy, trying to kill as many as possible. Gia, meanwhile, is looking at it from more of a Go perspective, trying to focus on how do I win as much territory as possible and thus defeat my enemy.
To combat the American aerial bombardment, Giap looks to a key Sun Tzu principle. Know your enemy and know yourself, and in 100 battles, you will never be in peril.
The way the Americans often operated was somewhat predictable. They would prepare a landing zone through artillery strikes and airstrikes, and then they would bring the troops in. Giap recognized this and realized that if he could have his troops hunker down and survive the artillery attacks, then when the troops landed, they would be able to set up ambushes to take them on.
The American bombs don't destroy the enemy. They merely telegraph that the U.S. infantry is on its way. Giap also orders his fighters to stay as close to American soldiers as possible.
Viet Cong have no tactical air. They also understand that once their positions get identified in any given battle, they're going to get whacked from the air. So how do you compensate for that? Well, General Giap said you grab the enemy by the belt. Put another way, what you want to do is you don't want to establish positions out there. And when they did defensively, for example, like at Hamburger Hill, you know, wham, they get hit by lots of air. But if you're in a tactical situation, you close with the enemy. You intermingle your forces with his so they can't bring air power to bear without hurting their own troops.
Free from U.S. bombs, Giap launches Sun Tzu-inspired guerrilla attacks against Americans on the ground. Ambushes, hand grenade booby traps, and snipers.
What Giap starts to do is close-in harassing raids against the Americans. And Sun Tzu likes this idea because by forcing the enemy to maneuver, to respond to you, he reveals strengths and weaknesses. And the more you know about his strengths and weaknesses, the more you can avoid the strengths and attack and exploit the weaknesses.
The major U.S. weakness in this war is not on the battlefield.
Now, our weakness was not in Vietnam. We never lost anything in Vietnam. We lost no engagements in Vietnam. But we did lose in the resolution of the American people to pursue the war. Giap realized this from the very start, and he did not try to defeat us in Vietnam. He tried to defeat us in the United States.
Jiap knows that if he can turn the American people against the war, he can defeat the overpowering U.S. military. In the beginning of the war, nearly 80% of Americans supported the military action in Vietnam. Between 1965 and 1967, President Johnson increases troop strength dramatically from 190,000 to almost 500,000. But more soldiers means more casualties.
Between 1959 and 1965, the U.S. had suffered 2,000 battle deaths. But then in 1966, it jumped to 6,000, and then in 1967, it jumped to 11,000. And this was because Westmoreland was enacting an attrition-based strategy. He wanted to take the battle to the North Vietnamese and try to kill as many of their soldiers as possible. And of course, this led to higher casualties among the Americans.
Ignoring the rising death toll and the potential political backlash, Westmoreland persists with his chess-like strategy.
One does not win wars by winning battles. That's a very archaic concept. The Romans learned this. They fought for 40 years in Spain. They fought for 30 years in England and still couldn't subdue the insurgencies. Battles and military operations are nothing more than means to an end, means to the achievement of strategic goals, okay? Those goals, by the way, are often political. What often happens to military men is they, as we used to say in the Army, you dance with who brung you. They're military guys. They got one trick. Their trick is war, okay? And what happens, and happens to us now, is that essentially the war and the battles become an end in itself without any consideration of whether or not it leads to the ultimate strategic goal of breaking the will of the enemy.
But no matter how bloody the battlefield gets, the Vietnamese will is never broken. Giap famously claims he's willing to lose 10 men for every one American. Many North Vietnamese troops wear a tattoo that says, "Born in the North to die in the South." And it's this difference that Giap knows will allow him to defeat the Americans, who now have more than 500,000 soldiers in Vietnam, many of whom don't want to be there.
Believe me, all conscripts want to do is get the hell out of country. You know, everybody arrives with what we call their DEROS date, date of expected return overseas. You know, scratch somewhere across your forehead, this is when I get to go home. And it's very hard to train them to do the kinds of stuff that Special Operations Forces have to do in order to fight an insurgency. So you put it all together, and it's a failure of strategic thinking, a failure to appreciate the cultural context in which things occurred, and inevitably deduce from that a failure to develop tactics that are effective.
To combat Giap's guerrilla insurgency, Westmoreland launches search and destroy missions throughout South Vietnam. He believes he is successfully rooting out Giap's Viet Cong insurgents. But a Pentagon report released after the war shows just how wrong he actually was.
What it found was that in more than 80% of the cases where American troops fought Viet Cong troops, that in fact it was the enemy that chose the time and place of the ambush. That in point of fact, we were not searching and destroying anything. In point of fact, if the enemy didn't want to fight, they just let us stumble on through the bush. But when they wanted to fight, it would pick the time and place.
Giap's guerrilla tactics are working. But his Sun Tzu-inspired strategy is suddenly overruled by his commanding officers. He is ordered to plan a full-scale direct offensive against the U.S. forces. Giap knows this is suicide, so instead he modifies the plan. Returning to Sun Tzu's principles, he decides to coordinate a simultaneous multi-pronged attack in hundreds of different locations across South Vietnam. The date for the attack? January 31st, 1968. Vietnam's Lunar New Year holiday called Tet. Giap has less than 9 months to plan his Tet Offensive, a Sun Tzu-inspired strategy that will prove to be a powerful turning point in the war. Sun Tzu says, "Let your plans be as dark as night, then strike like a thunderbolt." During the Vietnam War, North Vietnamese General Vo Nguyen Gia prepares his Tet Offensive in absolute secrecy. And just like the master Sun Tzu, Gia puts his faith in his spies.
Sun Tzu places a great importance on spies, and in fact, he devotes an entire chapter to the different types of spies and how they can be used.
Sun Tzu would have been impressed with General Giap's spy network in South Vietnam.
Giap understood that accurate knowledge of the enemy is worth 10 divisions. And so what happened was he literally had created a spy network that was unrivaled. I mean, every barman, every taxi driver, every taxi dancer, anyone who dealt with Americans was potentially a source of information for the Viet Cong.
The man who ran the taxi stand outside U.S. headquarters in Saigon is supposedly the chief of Viet Cong intelligence.
The point was by simply overhearing what Americans were saying, what soldiers were telling girls, the prostitutes, the drug dealers, all of this thing, by collecting that information together, able essentially to predict the movement of American units. And as a result, as the study later shows, we didn't surprise anybody. They knew we were coming almost all the time.
With up-to-the-minute information on his enemy, Giap moves forward with his plans for the Tet Offensive. The element of surprise is key, but means nothing if his men aren't sufficiently armed. Giap's next challenge is to figure out how to smuggle in and hide thousands of weapons throughout South Vietnam. The solution is all Sun Tzu: deception and secrecy. Giap goes underground.
What we found is an enormous complex of tunnels. It ran for miles and 3 and 4 levels deep. There were field hospitals below there, supply depots. It's where the VC and NBA would go to rest and recuperation. There were booze gals down there, and some of them ran underneath American base camps.
The largest of these tunnel complexes is north of Saigon in Cu Chi. Stretching from the Cambodian border, it has more than 75 miles of interconnecting passages. Built by the Vietnamese in the 1940s and 50s, the tunnels were originally dug out of the hard clay by hand with simple farm tools. Over the next decade, the tunnels are expanded and fortified with zigzags and sharp drops to resist U.S. attack. The Viet Cong adds secret entrances, camouflaged ventilation systems, and booby-trap doors.
How in all heck's name do you fight in tunnels? You use what we call tunnel rats, which were often urban Irish kids, little, not I say little, but you know, 5'5", 5'6", thin, but brave as hell. I mean, to go down through those holes into the tunnels armed only with a .45, sometime in a flashlight. I mean, that's really war up close and personal, never knowing what you were going to find on it.
Giap funnels tens of thousands of Viet Cong troops through these tunnels as the Tet Offensive draws nearer. With just 2 months until Tet, Giap plays what might be his greatest deception. Vietnam announces it will honor the traditional Tet ceasefire.
Part of the deception campaign is actually agreeing to a ceasefire over Tet. This really lulls the Americans and the South Vietnamese into thinking that they can relax their guard, send troops home, and there will be no conflict during those holidays.
Now, with Tet a little more than a week away, Giap launches a surprise attack on the remote U.S. base at Khe Sanh. U.S. Marines fight back waves of North Vietnamese soldiers that try to overrun the sprawling compound. The U.S. is determined not to lose Khe Sanh.
Lyndon Johnson actually has a scale model of the battlefield built that he can monitor it on a daily basis. He even goes and takes the step that he makes the Joint Chiefs of Staff sign a paper that says the Americans will not lose Khe Sanh.
But Khe Sanh is not Giap's real objective. It's a ploy to draw U.S. attention away from the cities before Tet. Sun Tzu would applaud Jiap's maneuver. Sun Tzu says, in battle, use a direct attack to engage and an indirect attack to win. In the art of war, you should always try to deceive your enemy. Pick a place you want to attack, then attack somewhere else to divert his attention. While he's distracted, capture your real objective. Jiap has done everything he can to prepare for the Tet Offensive. He uses spies, secrecy, and deception. The time to attack is now at hand. January 31st, 1968. Fireworks crackle. It's the Tet Lunar New Year. Suddenly, the celebration turns deadly. More than 80,000 Viet Cong troops carry out simultaneous individual attacks on more than 100 cities, villages, and U.S. bases all across South Vietnam. The Tet Offensive has begun.
The Americans and the South Vietnamese are shocked. They were stunned. They had thought the enemy was on his last legs, yet reports are coming in from everywhere, every city, every town, every base, that they're under attack.
U.S. commanders see the map of South Vietnam light up like a pinball machine.
We couldn't believe that they had moved this many troops this close to the cities, and they were very patient, had taken months to position arms there and troops and give them cover. An amazing, amazing logistical feat.
Jiap's informants lead the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese troops through the streets to strategic targets. One group captures the national radio station, while another blows a hole in the wall of the American embassy and fights its way onto the grounds. The Tet Offensive looks like it might succeed, but the North has ignored one very important Sun Tzu principle, and it will cost them. Sun Tzu says, there are five fundamental factors for success in war: weather, terrain, leadership, military doctrine, and most importantly, moral influence. Moral influence means a leader must have the will of the people behind him. Otherwise, a war will ultimately fail. It's an important clue in solving the mystery of whether Sun Tzu predicted America's demise in Vietnam. As the Tet Offensive rages in 1968, the Viet Cong carry blacklists and assassinate South Vietnamese sympathizers at will. One of the most brutal massacres takes place in the city of Hue.
They massacred 5,000 people in Hue, many of them government functionaries whose only crime was that they worked in a government agency. And also they literally shot several hundred nuns whose only crime was that they were Catholic nuns. That brutality, I think, backfired. A lot of Vietnamese said, wait a minute, this is not the kind of thing we do. It's not the kind of people we want to live under. But it was a terrible and, in my judgment, pointless massacre.
Without the will of the people, Jiap's small units are left without reinforcements. They have no idea what to do and no way to communicate with each other. Then, U.S. forces sweep in and devastate the fragmented North Vietnamese fighters. Thousand die in the first few days of the attack. While U.S. forces suffer only 250 casualties. Tet is a military disaster for the North Vietnamese. But Sun Tzu's concept of moral influence cuts both ways. When Americans see the images of the Tet Offensive on their television screens, popular support for the war rapidly erodes.
This had the effect of just simply turning everybody's feelings about the war upside down. We had thought we were winning in Vietnam, and we were finding that we were losing in Vietnam. And at that moment, I think everything changed in America.
Despite losing the battle, Giap is well on his way to winning the war by defeating the U.S. where it matters most, at home. After Tet, Giap returns to his guerrilla tactics. In 1975, with U.S. military support all but gone, Saigon finally falls to the North Vietnamese Army. At the end of the war, U.S. Colonel Harry Summers meets with North Vietnamese leaders to negotiate the American withdrawal.
Harry Summers had a meeting with Colonel Tu, his Vietnamese, North Vietnamese counterpart in Hanoi, probably getting a little angry at what was going on, and snapped at the colonel, the Vietnamese colonel. Well, the truth is, you never beat us on the battlefield. The Vietnamese colonel looked at him and said, well, that's true, he said, but it's also irrelevant. And there you have it. It was the political context that was important, far more than the military, as it always is throughout history. One more time to remember that war is a means to an end, and that end is almost always governed by politics, not by military victory or defeat.
This is a notion that General Giap well understood, as did the master, Sun Tzu. It's about 500 BC in ancient China. Sun Tzu's hit-and-run campaign against the Kingdom of Chu is working. Sun Tzu's adversary, the Chu Prime Minister Nang Hoa, grows frustrated and loses some political allies.
Nang Hoa and his generals are increasingly frustrated by Sun Tzu's cross-border raids. The constant harassment is undermining the morale of the Chu troops. Money is being drained out of the Chu treasury. In some cases, the best of Chu's warriors are either killed or captured by Sun Tzu. Faced with this dilemma, Nang Hoa is forced to turn to Chu's allies for men, money, and materiel.
Throughout the countryside, there is fear of where Sun Tzu will strike next. Leaders in the royal court begin to lose faith in Nang Hoa, and allies begin to defect to Sun Tzu's side. But this disloyalty doesn't come without punishment. Nang Hoa deploys his army to destroy a rogue ally in the north called Sai. As the capital is about to be attacked, the Duke of Sai calls on Sun Tzu for help. Sun Tzu now faces a seemingly no-win situation. If he does nothing, his ally will be destroyed. If he tries to save his ally, Nang Hoa will crush his army. But for Sun Tzu, the solution is simple. He leads a small force towards Sai to act as bait to draw Nang Hoa away from the city. It's a key principle of Sun Tzu's teaching. To move your enemy, entice him with something he is certain to take.
This is this whole idea of, in a sense, achieving kind of a maneuver dominance or controlling enemy movement by your own maneuver.
Nang Hoa immediately stops his siege on Sai and mobilizes his army to intercept Sun Tzu. Sun Tzu saves his ally without drawing a sword. But will he be able to save himself?
While Sun Tzu has succeeded in drawing Nang Hoa away from his siege of Sai, it seems that he's maneuvered himself into a trap. He's surrounded by Nang Hoa's forces.
Sun Tzu has placed his men where there is no possibility of retreat. He has placed them on death ground. Sun Tzu says, put the army in the face of death where there is no escape, and they will not flee or be afraid. There is nothing they cannot achieve. Sun Tzu studied every aspect of war, including the psychology of men facing imminent death.
Sun Tzu says that when the men know that they are in death ground, they will be transformed. They'll become overnight fearless fighters, that they will fight with all they have in order to win.
On Death Ground is exactly where Sun Tzu wants his soldiers. And it is on Death Ground that another great army finds itself, with the fate of the world hanging in the balance. June 6, 1944. Allied troops in World War II invade Europe. They land on the treacherous beaches of Normandy, France.
If you put troops on a beach from which there is no retreat, and there's almost no retreat from beaches, then they will fight because they have to fight to survive. And you can see this at Normandy.
What those men went through was almost unbelievable. When you see those beaches and you see what those men had to face, it's absolutely sobering to realize. And it makes you very proud to be an American, as far as I'm concerned.
How they survive and ultimately defeat the Nazis is predicted in the pages of Sun Tzu's Art of War. Sun Tzu says, all warfare is deception. If you can deceive your enemy before battle, you are more likely to win.
Imagine I got 10,000 soldiers, you got 1 million. Right, so what I had to do to counter you, right? I had to deceive you, right? Into splitting out your forces into more diverse groups.
Supreme Allied Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower takes this principle to heart as he prepares to invade Europe during World War II. His invasion strategy at Normandy is one of the most daring in history, and it's foreshadowed in the pages of Sun Tzu's Art of War. By 1944, Nazi Germany knows the Allies are coming, but they don't know where or when.
It's very clear at some point that in order to win World War II, the Allies would have had to invade the continent. And the buildup in England is the only place they could build up from. It meant it was going to come somewhere on the coast of France. The only question is where.
There are only three feasible locations where the Allies could land: the Pas-de-Calais, the Cherbourg Peninsula, or the Normandy beaches.
The reason why this was true is that the Allies were absolutely certain to only land on a beach that could be protected by the air power of the fighter planes that could fly out of southern England. The range of these fighters was 400 miles. Therefore, any landing site had to be within 200 miles of these beaches.
But even with air support, the Allies know a beach invasion of Europe is nearly impossible. To succeed, they must employ more of a go strategy than a chess strategy. So instead of a direct attack, the Allies follow Sun Tzu's principle of deception and convince the Germans the attack will not occur at Normandy.
One way Normandy is comparable to Go is the fact that the deception is involved. As you're playing Go, you are signaling by your moves which parts of the territory you're going to try and conquer.
What the Allies were able to do with the clever use of deception, as well as actually clear military logic, was to convince the Germans that when it came, it would come at Pas-de-Calais. And when in fact, they'd planned to come at Normandy.
It's called Operation Fortitude, and it's one of the most complex deception campaigns ever attempted. The Allies create a fake army that appears ready to strike at Calais. They use inflatable tanks, planes, and trucks to fool German photo reconnaissance.
They would move the tanks and the trucks around at night, and they would have men with rollers actually making the tracks so that there would actually be tracks in the ground so that it would look like there was a real movement of troops during the night.
The Phantom Army needs to be seen and heard, so Allied Army personnel broadcast endless hours of fake transmissions about troop and supply movements.
On the one hand, you would think it'd be a bit of a funny job because you're just sending bogus traffic. But on the other hand, it's a very important job that if they were lax in it or they didn't do it well, it would defeat the whole purpose of the deception plan.
Eisenhower shows the Germans his fake army, but keeps his real fighting force an absolute secret. For weeks, they are successful in their deception campaign. But 1 month before the D-Day invasion of Normandy is set to begin, the Allies fear their secret is out. British counterintelligence officers discover 5 crucial Normandy code names in a single newspaper crossword puzzle. Overlord, Neptune, Utah, Omaha, and Mulberry. British agents track down the creator of the crossword puzzle, a 54-year-old teacher named Leonard Daw.
And they interrogate him, and he gets very indignant and says, you know, am I not allowed to choose the words that I want for a crossword puzzle? And they press him, but at the end of the day, they figure out that he is actually telling the truth and that the words were actually just an accident.
With the scare behind them, the Allies must now actively sell the Germans on the Calais invasion threat. They turn to one of Sun Tzu's favorite methods, spies. Sun Tzu says it is essential to seek out enemy agents who have come to spy against you and bribe them to serve you.
In the art of war, double agents are the most important spies. Double agents begin as the spies that your adversary has sent to spy on you. When you find them out, you don't jail them or execute them. You hire them. You give them lavish rewards. And what they start to do then is they continue to act as if they're spying on you. But the information they feed back to your adversary is misinformation.
During World War II, nobody uses double agents better than the British. Their program is called Double Cross, and one of their key double agents is a Welsh naval contractor named Alfred Owen.
When the war breaks out, he's picked up right away, and they offer him a deal. Either come over and become a double agent for us, or essentially you go to prison, and many of them were executed. And he gets the code word Snow. And so when the Germans try to infiltrate their first wave of spies in September of 1940, the Germans radio Snow and let him know that these 4 agents are coming in. And of course, they're met with a British reception committee right away.
Double Cross is so successful that British intelligence is able to turn or imprison nearly every spy sent by Germany during the war. These double agents, with code names like Garbo, Brutus, and Tricycle, give such convincing misinformation that the Germans not only believe the invasion is coming to Calais, but it's the Normandy landing that's the diversion. Sun Tzu says, the way a wise general can achieve greatness beyond ordinary men is through foreknowledge. Sun Tzu teaches the importance of deception and foreknowledge to uncover the enemy's intentions. The Allies gain foreknowledge by breaking German codes. For years, the Germans believe their encoding machine, called Enigma, is completely unbreakable. It can scramble a message 150 million, million, million ways. But with the help of a Polish mathematician, British intelligence does the impossible. They are able to decode an intercepted German message within hours. They call their code-breaking system Ultra.
Through Ultra, the Allies know what the Germans are thinking, what their perceptions are of the battlefield, and their view of what's happening. Thus, they're able to feed German spies information that reinforces those misconceptions.
Sun Tzu would prize Ultra for its ability to read the mind of the enemy.
The art of war essentially is using the mind to fight the war, meaning to say that it is a mind-to-mind battle. So in order to win against the enemy, you must be able to read the mind of the enemy.
But sometimes, knowing what your enemy is thinking creates moral dilemmas. According to a British intelligence officer, on November 14, 1940, the British decode a German message about an impending attack on the English city of Coventry. If Churchill tries to protect Coventry, he could tip off the Germans that he's reading their messages.
It must have been a very, very difficult position to be placed in and a very difficult decision for him to make. And in this particular case, he was looking at the long-term Allied victory, and he essentially sacrificed the citizens of Coventry that were lost that night.
Coventry is devastated from the air. The destruction is so complete, the Germans coin a new phrase, Coventrated, to describe total obliteration of a town. The story is controversial, as there is no hard evidence to support the claim that Churchill was warned about the Coventry attack. As D-Day approaches, the Allies discover through Ultra and their network of spies that the Nazis still believe the invasion will come through Calais. Still, attacking Normandy will be difficult as the Germans establish defenses all along the coast. Sun Tzu would praise the Allies' preparation for the landing and their mastery of deception, but he would seriously condemn what they do once they arrive. Sun Tzu says, when a falcon strike breaks the body of its prey, it is because of timing. When torrential water tosses boulders, it is because of momentum. Sun Tzu believes even the most well-executed attack can be ruined if momentum is lost. The Normandy invasion shows that Sun Tzu could have predicted its outcome some 2,000 years earlier. After months of preparation and deception, Eisenhower launches his attack against German-occupied France. 150,000 ground troops, jammed onto hundreds of small landing craft, leave England and cross the English Channel. They'll land at five different beaches in France, codenamed Juno, Sword, Gold, Utah, and Omaha. As the landing craft approach the beaches, 15,000 aircraft and 7,000 ships provide a coordinated aerial assault on the beaches. At some of the landing sites, the Allied soldiers meet very little resistance. But at beaches like Omaha, it's hell on earth. For many of the Allied soldiers inside the landing craft, these moments before the door opens will be their last.
A case of incredible courage in the face of overwhelming horror. I mean, if you think about it, the landing crafts came up to the beach, and as they came up to the beach, the troops inside the landing craft could hear the machine guns tackering on the outside. The enemy machine gun is switched to what they call FCL, Final Coordination Line. They're gonna put as much machine gun fire on the front of that boat, so when it drops, bullets go right through and kill two or three guys at a time. A lot of guys just died that way.
Many don't make it off the boats. For the soldier lucky enough to survive the initial machine gun barrage, the nightmare is just beginning. He then has to cross 200 yards of mined tidal flats, weighed down with wet, heavy gear. Then get through another 100 yards of barbed wire beaches. It's three football fields of death and destruction as German machine guns shred fellow soldiers and friends.
If you ever get a chance to visit Omaha, it will change your whole view about the world. It will change your whole view about America. It will make you realize what incredible heroism was displayed by those guys there.
The Allies survive on death ground exactly the way Sun Tzu predicts, by fighting together and never giving up.
There was unmitigated horror, and still they kept coming. And you wonder, why, how? How do you make people do that? And perhaps Sun Tzu is in fact instructive here. You make them do that because there's no other alternative except death.
What are you going to do, turn around with equipment and swim back to England? There's no plan for evacuation unless you're wounded. There's no way you could refuse to get off the boat. So, in a sense, once you put that number of guys on the beach, you're following Sun Tzu in that you're putting an army in a situation where it must fight or die. And they fought. And they fought well, and they survived.
The Allies also benefit from another Sun Tzu principle, the poor judgment of their enemy's leader. Sun Tzu says it is essential for victory that generals are unconstrained by their leaders. The Allied command structure gives total authority to General Eisenhower as supreme commander of all forces on the Western Front. Beneath him are four commanders, one for the Navy, Air Force, the U.S. Army Group, and the British Army Group. In the business world, this would be a very clean org chart with well-defined responsibilities.
The great advantage that Eisenhower had that he could work with all sorts of people, and there were a huge number of prima donnas, and on both sides, he was able to work with these people and get them to work for the common good.
One would expect a dictator like Hitler to have an even more efficient chain of command than the Allies, but it's just the opposite. Hitler sets up a confusing system of overlapping authority.
He wanted to make sure that no one person beneath him had all of the information and or all of the control over forces at their disposal. And so by divvying it up, it always ensured that Hitler was the one that actually made the final decision on the disposition and the allocation of troops.
General von Rundstedt holds the title of Commander-in-Chief for forces in the West. But the Navy and Air Fleet each had separate command chains that aren't under his control and often don't cooperate with each other. The Waffen-SS, a separate military arm that fights alongside the German army, answers to Himmler, and Rundstedt has only indirect control of the mechanized divisions. Four tank units are under his command, but the remaining six are split between Army Groups B and G. It's a complete mess.
Hitler's leadership style and the chaotic command structure in the German army render Hitler a very cooperative adversary for a Sunzian-type campaign. He is constantly interfering in the decisions of his subordinates, the generals who should be acting objectively and professionally in trying to defend France against the Allied invasion.
One of Hitler's greatest blunders is how he deployed his prized Panzer tank divisions. Some generals believe the Panzers must be close to the beaches to knock the invading troops back into the sea. Others think the tanks should be held in reserve so they can be deployed in force wherever the Allies choose to land. Since none of the generals have the authority to make the call, the decision falls to Hitler.
And being Hitler, he made all the wrong decisions. He put one Panzer division in Holland and another Panzer division at the Bay of Biscay, both of which were entirely out of any range of a possible landing. And he put the rest of his Panzer divisions back some distance from the beaches.
Hitler's failure is a perfect example of why Sun Tzu says the enlightened general must be free to conduct war without interference from the leader.
When you look at the strategy for the German defense in France or in Normandy, it's very divided over how the defense should be arranged, what forces are actually available to defend the beaches, and what forces are actually available to reinforce the beaches or reinforce the German forces at the invasion point, because no one person has control of all of the forces as Eisenhower did on the Allied side.
The Allies achieve the impossible. Through bravery and determination, the troops are able to take all five landing sites at Normandy.
Despite all of the complex planning that went into the invasion of Normandy, it was the small unit tactics and the buddies fighting side by side that wins the Battle of the Beaches, and that's consistent throughout history.
Sun Tzu would have marveled at the timing and execution of the invasion. But soon, the Allies encounter a new and completely unexpected enemy. A labyrinth of giant, impenetrable hedgerows in what is known as the Bocage country of France.
It looks like the Allies have pulled off this amazing, miraculous feat, and they have. They've landed an army on the beaches of Normandy. but then they get bogged down in the hedgerow country. They had not anticipated that, despite the fact that the reconnaissance aircraft had photographed these hedgerows. The Allied planners simply assumed that these were like the hedges in a suburban backyard, 4 or 5 feet tall, maybe.
But these ancient hedges, dating back nearly 2,000 years, are 20 to 30 feet tall and extremely thick. They can't be climbed, tanks can't maneuver through them safely, and explosives would give away a unit's position.
The hedgerow country in Normandy threatens to completely undermine the momentum that the Allies need to build up.
The American army is a mechanized army, and you can't move tanks and trucks very quickly through hedgerows that are enormously thick.
The Allies' momentum stops dead in its tracks. 40 days pass, and they have only reached their day 5 objectives. Casualties mount to more than 78,000, and the entire invasion is in jeopardy. But the solution on how to escape this enormous maze lies in the pages of Sun Tzu's Art of War. Sun Tzu says, "Make your enemy prepare on his left, and he will be weak on his right." In Normandy, France, the Allies are getting pummeled in the hedgerows of the Bocage country. Terrain perfectly suited for German ambushes and snipers.
The Germans have a word for close order combat in terrain that's very complex and closed. It's called Rattenkrieg. It means literally the war of the rats. It means, in essence, that warfare gets reduced to almost individual combat. One or two men against one or two men, because the terrain, in this case the hedgerows, won't allow you to maneuver, won't allow you to bring your technological advances of artillery, air power, mobility to tanks to bear. So the war in the hedgerows was a terrible war. It was up close and personal.
But perhaps what's most deadly in the hedgerows are the German panzer tanks prowling the maze.
The British actually had a pamphlet on how to hunt tanks. They would send out specialized teams of individuals with bazookas, or piets, as the British and the Canadian armies call them, in order to actually hunt down tanks and take them out. And the manual actually likens it to big game hunting, where you're out stalking a tiger or an elephant and trying to take it down.
Eventually, the Allies devise a Sun Tzu-inspired strategy to help free themselves from the carnage of the Bocage country. The plan is to lure most of the German forces fighting at the Bocage to the city of Caen, so a weakened force is left behind.
Primarily because Caen had airfields and it was closest to Paris, and so the Germans were fairly sure that we would attack through Caen.
The Allied plan begins with Operation Goodwood, a blistering barrage of air power against the city of Caen. The Germans take the bait and move many of their panzer tank divisions away from the Bocage, leaving only 1.5 divisions behind to hold back the U.S. forces in the hedgerows. The U.S. immediately takes advantage of the shift and strikes with a withering air attack on the remaining German panzer tank divisions. It's called Operation Cobra.
Sun Tzu says, you must behave like the snake. Why? So that when you attack on the front, the back will reinforce the front. You attack in the rear, the front can reinforce that point. And you attack the middle, both sides could come in. So for Sun Tzu, right, it is really that the enemy attacking you, in your responses, you must be flexible.
With nearly all of the German tanks destroyed, U.S. forces are able to punch a hole in the German line with artillery, tanks, and infantry. Finally, after weeks of frustration, the Allies break out of the Bocage. The diversion of Goodwood at Caen and the success of Cobra in the Bocage country changes the strategic equation. The stalled Allied momentum returns with a vengeance. Throughout the Normandy invasion, Sun Tzu's invisible hand guides the Allies to victory through their use of deception, foreknowledge, and a superior command structure that motivates the entire army to fight as one. Sun Tzu says, "The winning army realizes the conditions for victory first, then fights. The losing army fights first, then seeks victory." The battle between the kingdoms of Wu and Chu rages. Sun Tzu's small Wu force is on death ground. They are surrounded by the army of the Chu Prime Minister, Nan Hua. But Sun Tzu isn't worried. While Nan Hua's army attacks, Sun Tzu's main force is headed to capture the Chu capital of Ying.
When Nan Hua realizes that Sun Tzu's main force is bent on the attack on Ying, he has a tough decision to make. Obviously, he wants to kill Sun Tzu. He wants to wipe out this force under Sun Tzu's command. But while he doesn't think the Wu force, the main body, is much of a threat to the Chu capital, he's afraid that the defender of Ying, another general, will win credit for defending the capital against the Wu forces. As a result, he races back to defend Ying.
It will be Nan Hua's most colossal mistake of the war. Like Nan Hua, generals throughout history have charged headlong into battle without having all the information they need. Thousands of years later, in the farmlands of Pennsylvania, another general rushes into battle without knowing what lies ahead. He is Confederate General Robert E. Lee, who some consider the greatest commander in American history. But at Gettysburg, Lee fails to heed Sun Tzu's wisdom and pays a terrible price. Sun Tzu says, "No nation has ever benefited from prolonged war." The American Civil War is Sun Tzu's nightmare scenario. A bloody stalemate that will end up costing more than 620,000 lives. By far, the deadliest war in American history.
By 1863, it's pretty clear on both sides that this is not going to be the short war everyone thought it was going to be when, at the Battle of Manassas, the ladies and gentlemen drove out of D.C. in their carriages with picnic lunches to observe what they thought would be the first and last battle of the war. Everybody knows now it's going to be a long war.
The war affects every American, sometimes in unexpected ways. The Civil War sees the creation of the first American psychiatric hospital at St. Elizabeth's in Washington, D.C., still in operation today. The war between the North and South also affected how Americans receive their mail. A Cleveland postmaster becomes so distraught by the sight of anxious wives and children lining up at his post office that he institutes home delivery for the very first time. Though what many homes receive are death notices.
The turkey buzzards realized that whenever they saw an army, that sooner or later there would be flesh to eat. And as the armies moved along, they often moved along with hundreds of turkey buzzards overhead, just waiting for the battlefield, waiting for the carnage, waiting for the open wounds, peck out their eyes and eat the innards as they would any other carrion. An almost horrific scene, but that's what war is. Pretty horrific in times.
Civil War field hospitals are human butcher shops, with arms and legs stacked in piles. Some 40,000 amputations are performed on the Union side alone, only 24,000 of them under anesthesia. Doctors perform dozens of surgeries, without ever washing their hands.
It was 7 times safer to fight through the entire Battle of Gettysburg than it was to be sent to an army hospital. The death rate there was 30% and 40%. Taking the limb off was just one part of it. Now you had the problem of gangrene, suppuration, infection, and the death rates were just staggeringly high.
The American Civil War is a classic example of why Sun Tzu warns against going to war in the first place. But other principles in the art of war will prove instrumental in how the war eventually ends. Sun Tzu says, those skilled in war bring the enemy to the field of battle. They are not brought by him. Pennsylvania, 1863. The Civil War is a bloody stalemate. By the end of June of that year, Confederate General Robert E. Lee boldly moves his army of nearly 60,000 men into Union territory. While most of the battles of the American Civil War have been fought in the South, Lee decides the moment is right to invade Union soil. Lee's plan? Destroy as many military posts as possible in Maryland and Pennsylvania while Union armies defend Washington, D.C. One key target is Camp Curtin, outside of Harrisburg, the largest military supply depot in the North.
The strategy of Lee's attack on the North is not primarily military, it's primarily political. And he's going to try to essentially to defeat Lincoln politically. What he hopes is a massive defeat of the North will encourage people to lose faith in the war.
Lee's bold military action to achieve a political victory is more of a go strategy than a chess strategy, exactly the kind of plan Sun Tzu would have admired. But as Lee's main force moves north, a skirmish erupts in Gettysburg between two cavalry units.
Confederate General Heath had a division at Cashtown, and he wanted to move over to Gettysburg in order to get some shoes that were in a factory there. That was the only reason he went. In this fashion, he moved without any understanding of what lay ahead of him, and in the process set off the greatest war that's ever been fought in the Western Hemisphere.
Lee gets word of the skirmish and is told that a major Union force is at Gettysburg. Instead of sending a cavalry reconnaissance force to confirm the report, Lee orders his entire army to mobilize. It's a colossal mistake.
Lee decides to abandon the original plan. He gives up what we call strategic aim, and he makes the mistake of allowing operational developments to drive strategy.
Lee orders all his forces to converge at Cashtown, a small village 7 miles from Gettysburg. Sun Tzu would not like his choice, as Cashtown has not been fully scouted.
Had Robert E. Lee read Sun Tzu, he would have known better than to proceed on what you think is happening and try to spend the resources to find out what really is happening.
Sun Tzu says, move only when you see an advantage and there is something to gain. Only fight if a position is critical. Some 60,000 Confederate troops begin to pour in from nearby Cashtown and Carlisle. 3,000 Union soldiers take position on McPherson Ridge. They try to hold off the onslaught of enemy soldiers until help arrives. But reinforcements are miles away toward Washington, D.C. So the Union soldiers withdraw southeast onto Cemetery Ridge, a range of hills that forms the shape of a fishhook. Cemetery Ridge provides an extremely strong defensive advantage.
The terrain is so obvious in favor of the defense that my guess is almost any second lieutenant from West Point would have chosen that ground given the opportunity to do it.
When Union General Hancock arrives, he declares it the best natural position he's ever seen. Lee immediately sees the danger of the Union's position. But because Union troops are still straggling in, he believes they are vulnerable Lee then gives an order to Confederate General Ewell that many believe isn't really an order at all.
And Lee says to him, attack when you think it's practical. Didn't order him to attack. Ewell, new on the battlefield, doesn't know what the hell's going on, and decides not to attack.
Ewell decided that it was not practical because his troops were tired and they were exhausted and he wanted a rest.
While some criticize Ewell for not following orders, Sun Tzu's own words place the blame on Lee.
If we look all the way back to this famous interview between King Hulu of Wu and Sun Tzu, in that incident with the palace concubines, the importance of clarity in orders. Sun Tzu says at that point, if the orders are unclear, it is the fault of the general. At Gettysburg, we see Lee issuing very unclear and very ambiguous orders to his subordinates.
Union reinforcements soon arrive and strengthen their position. Lee now faces an uphill battle. Sun Tzu says, when the enemy occupies high ground, do not confront him. If he attacks downhill, do not oppose him. As night falls on the first day of the Battle of Gettysburg, Lee confers with another Confederate general, James Longstreet, a man who grasps the situation from Sun Tzu's perspective. Longstreet wants Lee to abandon the idea of attacking the Union high ground. Instead, he wants to march south around Cemetery Ridge, then east right toward Washington, D.C.
And this will force the Union Army to come off Cemetery Ridge and attack us where we are. And if they attack us, we will win. This would have been precisely what Sun Tzu would have recommended.
But Lee says no. He points to Cemetery Ridge and says, the enemy is there, and I am going to attack him there. Lee has completely given up his go strategy and reverts back to chess.
Longstreet is stunned. He sees the Union Army dug in on the hills and knows that they should not be attacked. Sun Tzu would have advised against it. He would have said, assess the situation, adjust your forces, find another way to attack the enemy.
But Lee doesn't listen. The second day of Gettysburg is hell on earth. Bucolic pastures are transformed into fields of slaughter. Places like Plum Run, the Peach Orchard, and Little Round Top see some of the bloodiest hand-to-hand combat of the war.
What's terrible about hand-to-hand combat is the memories. You know, for a lot of war, you can pull the trigger and maybe you see somebody drop. Maybe. Most often you don't. But this is up close and personal. This is bayonets, knives, rifle butts, pistol shots in the head, in the face, and you see it. And it takes a piece out of you. And that's why you have psychiatric casualties. God knows how many members of both sides remember that battle, you know, every night for the rest of their lives. And it's just gory beyond belief.
On top of Little Round Top is Union Colonel Joshua Chamberlain and the 20th Maine Regiment. They have survived three Confederate charges and are nearly out of ammunition.
And here comes the fourth attack. And Chamberlain orders fixed bayonets. Everybody fires the last two rounds they got, stands up, and in a great moment in history, stands on the wall with a saber and gives the command, which rings through the years of American infantry history. Follow me, boys. Bayonets forward. And down they go.
Union troops howl down the hill. Shocked at the charge, the Confederate soldiers retreat. Against all odds, the Union hangs on to Little Round Top. Sun Tzu's principle of never attacking an enemy on high ground holds true. But this does not seem to deter Lee, for he's going to ignore Sun Tzu yet again and order his men to attack uphill one more time. Sun Tzu says, there are some armies that should not be fought, some ground that should not be contested. The sun rises on the third day of the Battle of Gettysburg. Despite the thousands of dead bodies strewn across the fields, Confederate General Robert E. Lee is about to order his troops to attack the high ground yet again.
One of the things you never want to do in war, never throw good money after bad. Follow the advice of Sun Tzu. Use an attack to exploit a victory. Never use an attack to rescue a defeat. And Longstreet gets it.
General Longstreet once again suggests to Lee that they should move around Cemetery Ridge and threaten Washington, D.C. to draw the Union off the high ground.
Longstreet understands that the Confederates are in a terrible position. They are outnumbered. They do not have the high ground. They have suffered terrible casualties in the last 2 days of fighting, and that there's no real chance of pushing the Union Army off the high ground.
But Lee feels his men have sacrificed too much to turn back now. Lee gives the order to attack. The infantry charge is led by Major General George Pickett.
The story is Dutch Longstreet is sitting there, and Pickett says, "Shall I go, General? Shall I go?" And Longstreet just drops his head and looks away. "General, shall I go?" And Longstreet again looks away. He said, "General, I'm going into the attack." And Longstreet looked again away. Longstreet never gave the order to attack. He knew it was suicidal.
In the sweltering July heat, 12,500 Confederate soldiers led by Pickett make their determined march across an open field nearly a mile long. As they advance in close ranks, thousands are cut down by Union artillery and rifle fire.
There was nowhere they could hide. There was almost no range between the Union forces and the Confederate forces, and the Union forces were simply able to stand behind these reinforced positions and fire on the Confederates. And so the Confederates had no way of defending themselves.
To Pickett's men's bravery, they continued all the way up. There's one whole unit from South Carolina that marched straight into the Rhode Island artillery guns and was destroyed by canister shot. The whole unit died instantaneously. Just tore through people, limbs, heads, eyes, blood, hair, and eyeballs everywhere.
Of the more than 12,000 Confederate soldiers who made the charge, only 5,000 survive. The Battle of Gettysburg is over.
Sun Tzu would have been horrified at the tragic waste of Pickett's charge. Sun Tzu always believed in using the intellect rather than force, and never attacking headlong an enemy force if he could do otherwise.
At Gettysburg, Lee doesn't adjust his strategy to the situations on the ground. He refuses to retreat, even when the situation is clearly hopeless.
And Lee takes off his hat, dismounts, and walks into the field and says, "It's all my fault, boys. It's all my fault." "You're damn right, General. It's all your fault." No one in his right mind would have ordered that. You should have listened to Sun Tzu.
In the end, his failure to follow Sun Tzu's wisdom is one of the factors that costs the Confederates the war. Sun Tzu says, when troops flee, are insubordinate, collapse, or are routed in battle, it is the fault of the general. In The Art of War, Sun Tzu imagines the role of the supreme general, a man who must be intelligent and cunning, never rash nor arrogant. Exactly the opposite of Sun Tzu's adversary in the Wu Chu War, Nang Hua.
Sun Tzu is deadly against impulsive behavior, rash behavior, or making the army march double quick time in order to seize the victory. For in Sun Tzu's mind, victory comes from deep thinking, from detailed calculation, from long preparation.
While Nanhua has a larger, more powerful army, Sun Tzu shows he is the master by outwitting his enemy. Nanhua rushes to his capital, believing Sun Tzu is about to invade. But the master never had any intention of attacking such a well-protected city. It's a ruse to lure Nanhua into a trap, and it works perfectly. Without warning, more than 20,000 of Sun Tzu's elite warriors ambush Nanhua's forces. The surprise attack throws Nanhua's men into confusion.
What we have now is a series of running battles between Nanhua's much depleted forces and Sun Tzu's main force. In each battle, Nanhua gets weaker, Sun Tzu gets stronger, and the Chu capital lays exposed.
Sun Tzu joins up with his main force and attacks the disorganized Chu army. Finally, Sun Tzu has won the war. Through preparation, deception, and indirect attacks, Sun Tzu pulls off one of the greatest upsets in history. But as mysteriously as he arrived, Sun Tzu leaves and disappears.
There's some speculation as to why he disappears. One theory is that the behavior of the leaders of Wu shock him, discourage him. When the king of Wu enters the Chu capital, he's dumbstruck by its wealth. He becomes greedy and covetous. It would seem then that Sun Tzu has provided this ambitious and potentially corrupt king with a dangerous instrument, this new military that he's honed. He also sees infighting breaking out. And perhaps this is the moment that Sun Tzu retires from this life and goes instead to write what he sees as the lessons of the conflict between Wu and Chu.
The first line of Sun Tzu's Art of War is, "War is a matter of vital importance to the state. It is a matter of life and death, survival or ruin." Sun Tzu knows that war can lead to disaster. Sometimes, the best way to win is not to fight at all. This is perhaps Sun Tzu's ultimate secret.
Nations often rush into wars with very little concern for thinking through what the total cost is going to be, not just in dollars, but also in terms of human suffering, not only to you, but to the civilians and children of the country in which you're fighting. It's the kind of thing that, you know, we find in Sun Tzu, that, you know, before you go to war, think this through, and then ask yourself, is the reasons for which you're fighting worth the total cost of the war? Or is there another way?
As Sun Tzu says, the angry can be made happy again, but the dead cannot be brought back to life. Still, some historians believe the genius behind the Art of War wasn't actually Sun Tzu, but a collection of different strategists. While his existence is debated, his legacy isn't. Today, the Art of War is read by generals, CEOs, and professional sports coaches. And while it offers us insights into the battles of the past, it could prepare us for the wars of the future.
Sun Tzu is extremely relevant to us today because the rules that he laid down 400 BC are the same rules that we apply to warfare today or should apply to warfare today. The recommendations for indirect warfare that we learned from Sun Tzu are the way we need to fight wars today, because there's no way we can continue to fight direct, heavy, conventional wars, because no other army is going to attack us in a conventional fashion. We're going to have to use the indirect methods of dealing with the enemy that that Sun Tzu recommended, and the quicker we learn these, the more likely we'll be successful in our wars of the future.
Sun Tzu can teach us not merely to know ourselves, to know our strengths, our weaknesses, what we're capable of doing on the battlefield, but constantly reminds us that is as important, if not more so, to cultivate a deep, fundamental understanding of our adversaries so that we might better achieve our objectives. That's what I think makes it a possession for all time.
Throughout history, Sun Tzu's principles have guided the outcome of war. We must embrace his wisdom or fight in darkness.